Nobody can be too Jewish.
That's exactly it. You got it.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Jonathan Ornstein, the executive director of the Krakow Poland JCC, which just celebrated its 10th anniversary and hosted the 5th annual Ride for Living. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our two Jewish maven on Israel, Amir Eden, and our Shinshinim Chen Denachi and Tamir Shakuri. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. I recently returned from a trip to Poland where I had the great pleasure and privilege of participating in the Ride for the Living, a 55-mile bicycle ride from Auschwitz-Birkenau death camp to the Jewish community center of Krakow, Poland. From the scene of the greatest destruction of our people to a place of great renewal, energy, hope, and Jewish vitality. My son Boaz and I traveled to Germany, Poland, and the Czech Republic on this journey, but mostly we visited Warsaw, Krakow, and Gdansk, all places of both general and tremendous Jewish interest. Two of my grandparents were born and grew up in Poland, and up until the Holocaust, there was 1,000 years of vibrant Jewish life in the country, which in the 1930s had more Jews than any other country in the world, about 3 million. Roughly 10% of the population of Poland. Until 3 years ago, I never had any real desire to visit Poland for, well, fairly obvious reasons. Most of what I'd heard about it was the shtetl and the general anti-Semitism suffered by the Jews at the hands of their Gentile neighbors and the periodic historic brutality by invading Russians, Germans, and Cossacks, all followed by the Shoah, the horrific annihilation of the Jewish people by the Nazis. I knew of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising in 1943, its horrible suppression by the Nazis, and the catastrophic destruction of European Jewry. To me, Poland symbolized a Jewish graveyard. There was no reason to visit it. And then, in 2015, I attended the 70th anniversary of the liberation of the Auschwitz-Birkenau death camp, where 2 million Jews were systematically murdered by the Nazis. It was a moving ceremony and powerful. But along the way, in the course of visiting Krakow and Warsaw, Góra Kalowaria, and Częstochowa, I discovered that Poland was a very different place than I had been led to believe. For one thing, while the contemporary Jewish population is tiny compared to what it was before the Holocaust and the subsequent 45 years of communist-era repression, still, it was vibrant and deeply interested in reviving Jewish identity, spirituality, and study. For another, the young Poles I met were very interested in Judaism, the non-Jewish ones, and they often expressed how something was missing in their country, something. Well, that something was the Jewish population that had been integral to their nation and culture for a millennium. This was most evident in Krakow, the second largest city in Poland, and in many ways its cultural capital, a beautiful place of gorgeous old buildings ranging from castles to cathedrals to elegant 19th century palaces, and a vibrant and active Jewish quarter. I discovered that the JCC had many non-Jewish young Poles who energetically volunteered and worked there and found it to be a centrally fulfilling place. They helped Holocaust survivors. They were learning about Judaism. They were active and committed to the development of Jewish life anew. That trip in January 2015 that coordinated with the Auschwitz Liberation Anniversary was also partly to visit the man who had received our family's foundation, the Kohan Memorial Foundation's award, for his work for Jewish unity and education. He had founded the JCC in Krakow. That's our guest this morning, Jonathan Ornstein. Mind you, I went in January. It was brutally cold, but still I found myself captivated by Poland. The people were warm and kind, the food shockingly good, and there was so much to see that was both culturally interesting and, well, frankly, fascinating. This time, we went back in summer, when Poland is pleasant and it only rains a bit each day, and when the Ride for the Living was timed to coincide with the largest Jewish festival in all of Europe, which takes place in Krakow at the end of June. I asked my son Boaz if he was interested in a post-college graduation trip in which we'd indulge in our mutual enjoyment of cycling, connect to a fascinating Jewish revival, and see some of Poland in Europe. He surprised me by not only being interested but eager to go. He said he wanted to see a concentration camp firsthand, Auschwitz in particular, and felt it was important to assert a positive Jewish presence in Poland, while the Polish government has just passed a law criminalizing any mention that Poland was complicit in the Holocaust. And so we decided to go. We went and had an extraordinary time of it, exploring Warsaw and its phenomenal Pauline Museum, which traces 1,000 years of Jewish history in Poland creatively and beautifully. It was voted the top museum in all of Europe a couple years ago. We went to the Polish Uprising Museum in Warsaw, a memorial to the Poles who fought against the Nazis. I helped lead Shabbat services in both Warsaw and Krakow, which led to friendships and connections with some of the vibrant non-Orthodox Jewish communities there. We toured Gdansk, a lovely city on the Baltic, where the Solidarity movement began, which ultimately defeated communism in Poland and started its fall everywhere behind the Iron Curtain. And we came to Krakow, experienced its charm and beauty, attended some of the Jewish festival events and concerts, then toured Auschwitz, and the next day participated in the incredible Ride for the Living itself. There is no way to fully describe the solidarity experienced by riding with over 200 people joined together for this purpose. We began in front of the entrance gates of Auschwitz with speeches by 2 Holocaust survivors who rode with us and by those people who originated the ride and coordinated it. And of course, well, Greg LeMond, the 3-time Tour de France winner, the first American to win the most important cycle race in the whole world, rode with us. He was just fantastic, friendly, open, delightful. He came because he understood what it all stood for, paid his own way, and was a great co-rider. When we rode into Krakow after having traveled the 55-mile route, by the way, this is the only day we were in Poland when it didn't rain at all. It was just a beautiful ride through a gorgeous countryside, and then past the magnificent walls and castle and into the city. Anyway, when we rode in with Marcel Zielinski, who survived Auschwitz and walked this same route at the age of 10 in 1945, hoping to find some of his family, and with Greg LeMond and Jonathan Ornstein and a host of new friends, it was an incredible moment to remember forever, and it was magnificent to share it with my own son. And then I rushed off to lead progressive Shabbat services for a couple of 100 folks at the High Synagogue in the Kazimierz Jewish area of Krakow. Well, you'll hear more about the Krakow JCC from our guest this morning, Jonathan Ornstein. We caught up with him during the days before the Ride for the Living. To play us in this morning, here's a group we heard at the great outdoor concluding concert of the Krakow Jewish Festival, the Jerusalem Orchestra East and West. 15,000 fans in attendance, mostly non-Jewish Poles, just totally into the Jewish music. That was the Jerusalem Orchestra, East and West, playing at the Krakow Jewish Festival this year. Our guest this morning, Jonathan Ornstein, founded one of the most remarkable institutions in the whole Jewish world, the JCC of Krakow, Poland, which is central to the rebirth of vibrant Jewish life in Poland. Meet him. Well, he's actually an old friend. Meet him again as we celebrate the 10th anniversary of the Krakow JCC and hear about the fifth Ride for the Living and the current situation for Jews in Poland, all when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
I am delighted to welcome back to Too Jewish our guest this morning. Jonathan Ornstein is the head of the Jewish Community Center in Krakow, Poland, one of the really outstanding institutions in the Jewish world. And we are here for the Jewish Festival. Good morning and welcome back to Too Jewish.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here with you, Rabbi.
So I'm going to dig right in. Poland has been in the news too much, maybe, since I guess about February, when the, for want of a better term, the government of Poland, right-wing Law and Justice Party, passed a law criminalizing criticism of Polish involvement in the Shoah. That's not entirely correct, but that's the way the story's been reported. Can you give us a little bit of the background, and we can update it as much as we can at this point?
Sure. I mean, the law, I think, draws a distinction which we don't always draw, which is it criminalizes saying that Poland as a nation or the state was responsible for the Holocaust, which we, of course, know it wasn't responsible for the Holocaust as a state, because Germany invaded Poland, and Germany was the perpetrator of the Holocaust. And there were individual Poles who did good things in terms of helped Jews during the war, and there were individual Poles who hurt Jews during the war. And I think the law, the way it was worded, was not, I think the intent was not for it to necessarily criminalize people talking about what individuals did, but the law was written in very unclear language, and this is where I think all the problems started, because it wasn't clear if somebody would be talking about an individual situation where a Pole did something harmful to Jews during the war, and then that would be something that could be termed in violation of this law.
Which would have been extremely problematic, because that would be simply reporting history and historical facts. It looks like they're going to clarify the law.
Yeah, so there's a lot going on. Today there was actually some news about the law that they are removing the punishment aspect of the law. So the law stays on the book, except that there's no
criminal
aspect to it. So it's sort of defanged. So, I mean, essentially a law with no aspect of any punitive aspect is not really, then there's nothing, really not much to it. That's before the Constitutional Tribunal rules on it, which is what happened. The president signed the law, making it the law of the land,
right.
But referred it to the Constitutional Tribunal, and they haven't acted yet. But now there's news that has just come out that the law, even before the Constitutional Tribunal will act, will remove the punitive, or remove the punishment, the aspect of having any type of penalty attached to it.
Kind of decriminalizes, it's still criminal, but there's no punishment associated with it.
Yeah, so I mean, I'm not a lawyer, so I'm not an expert on this, but essentially right. So in other words, before, if you violated this law, it could be up to, you know, a certain fine and up to 3 years in jail, and I think now that whole aspect has been removed.
So we will talk about the many positive and exciting things going on here in Krakow at the Jewish Festival with the Jewish Community Center, but I think it was important to address that. We may come back to the overall situation for Jews in Poland as well with Jonathan Ornstein, the head of the Jewish Community Center in Krakow, in a moment here on Too Jewish.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through our website, twojewishradio.com, streaming us from there, or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as popular Jewish podcast top 10 in America, according to Moment magazine. We welcome our maven on Israel, Amir Eden, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Amir.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
Now, I know that your favorite sport is, of course, the same favorite sport as everybody in Israel, which is football or soccer.
Right. Kaduregel in Hebrew.
Kaduregel. Yes. I know Kadursal has made a kind of an impact on Israel. Basketball is a big deal.
Yes.
But it's not football. Tell us a little bit about your love of football and the World Cup and Israel's place in that and the complexity of it all.
Yeah. So my love to soccer started when I was 8 years old and, you know, played in the neighborhood and then went to play for the team that plays for my hometown, okay, like the number one team. And grew up with great coaches and mentors. And when I came to the States, I played for college in Florida. And then became a coach when I got older and coached many, many teams, boys and girls in middle school and high school and clubs. And had, you know, I have lots of good memories.
And I should note, it is by far the most popular sport in the world.
It is.
But definitely
not
in
the States, but yeah.
Not in America.
Not yet. Yeah. But you know what? I just found out that we're going to host the World Cup in 2026.
U.S., Mexico, and Canada, the preliminary matches in Mexico and Canada.
Correct. Look, it's a big excitement.
Huge deal.
We're starting to plan.
Maybe we can even qualify America, which we didn't this time around.
Yeah, that was
disastrous.
That was sad.
Very sad.
But I can tell you that, so about soccer, you know, World Cup in Israel is a big thing. Yes, we didn't qualify. Actually, the last time we qualified, the only time was 1917 in Mexico. but you know,
no, I should add something. There's
sure.
There's a good reason why Israel doesn't qualify. Which
yes,
is,
it's a harder match because the
Israel can't compete
division,
in Asia.
Right, no one is going to play against us.
Yes,
in,
so when
the Arab countries,
Saudi Arabia may qualify, Egypt may qualify. Israel
right,
would have
Morocco,
a pretty Israel would have a pretty good shot against those clubs if they would play Israel.
Correct.
Instead, Israel has to qualify with Europe, which is by far the most difficult region in the world.
Correct, yeah. So, yeah, we do compete against Europe, and believe it or not, sometimes even South America, like Colombia.
Yep.
So it's really hard. And we're all waiting. All the fans are waiting for the day that we're going to qualify. My wife, Sharon, knows that when we qualify, I'm there.
You're going.
Not like watching it on TV, but like at the stadium. And she said yes, because you know it's going to be very, very hard for us. So what happens in Israel, the World Cup is a celebration, you know, every 4 years. So the pubs and the restaurants, they have great deals and large screen TVs and there are beautiful places like on the beach.
I know I was in Israel during the last World Cup and people were, because I forget what time the matches were, 2 a.m, giant TVs on the beach in Tel Aviv watching
the World
Cup.
I'll tell you one nice experience. We were already living in the States. It was about 8 years ago. And we went to Israel knowing that Argentina is going to play against Brazil. Now, not a lot of people know, but in Israel, it's funny. There are a lot of kibbutzim that actually were established by a certain group that came from a certain country. So, for example, Baruch Hayil is Brazilian. Oraner, Argentinian. So the two kibbutzim are rivals, you know, when it comes to soccer. Obviously, good neighbors during the year.
But
so there was a festival with meat, you know, what we call a la ish barbecue.
Yeah, barbecue.
And obviously soccer and a lot of music, samba, you know, so it was really amazing. They came together and put
their differences aside, they didn't kill each other over soccer and
celebrate it, you know, like Brazilians, Argentinians, and Israelis know how to do.
Fantastic. Well, best of luck, even though neither Israel nor America is in the World Cup, but it's still a great celebration. Thanks, Amir. We'll talk next week.
Thank you.
Today is a somber day in Jewish tradition, the fast day of Tisha B'Av, ninth day of the month of Av, which commemorates the destruction of both the first and second temples and several other disasters that befell our people on this date. It was on this same date that the expulsion of the Jews of Spain took place in 1492 and other notably awful historic events. Tisha B'Av is an annual reminder that no matter how well things may be going for Israel or for Jews in the world, there's always the distinct possibility another shoe will drop, and ancient hatreds, animosities, and the insanities of anti-Semitism will resurface in tangible and terrible ways. That's not to say we must dwell on this today. Well, at least not regularly. But at least today on Tisha B'Av, we do well to fast and remember and hope that this will never again be a time when we need to recall such terrible events. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
There was a great deal of publicity in May about the U.S. Embassy moving from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, the Israeli embassy, the U.S. Embassy in Israel, and huge events and celebrations and lots of international controversy. But there was a little known technical piece that took place not too long ago that testifies that all is not exactly as it seems.
Right. And first of all, just to set the record straight, there wasn't only controversy and celebration. A lot of lives were lost. Palestinians who demonstrated in Gaza died in large numbers. And there's a lot of controversy about that, even inside Israel, let alone on the international stage. And that series of events has hardened the resolve of a lot of our European allies not to follow suit and move their embassies to Jerusalem. However, as I said at the time, it's largely theoretical. This highly trumpeted move, in fact, moved the sign saying Embassy of the United States of America, and maybe one or two of the hundreds of personnel at our embassy in Tel Aviv, and maybe a couple of files in some symbolic way. But meanwhile, a month or so later, the president signed the required waiver to an act of Congress requiring that we move the embassy to Jerusalem. And by law, the president has to sign a waiver every 6 months postponing that.
Right, as presidents
unless
did,
he actually moves the embassy.
Right, as presidents did from George W. Bush through Obama, they kept signing the waiver and pushing
this is
it off
like
6 months down the road.
At least 20 years old,
right.
this requirement. So, interestingly, and in a rare acknowledgement of reality on the ground, the president signed this waiver postponing the move, which theoretically already happened. And as I said at the time, I mean, there's all kinds of things that have to happen before you can move an embassy. You have to find a suitable ambassador's residence. You have to find a piece of property that's big enough to build a secure embassy with a decent setback from the road and all that. You have to build a building that's large enough really to house an embassy. And the current building, which everyone thought while it was being built would be the site of the new embassy, is barely big enough to serve as our consulate. And an embassy is far bigger. We still have hundreds of people, including local Israeli citizen employees, working at the embassy in Tel Aviv, which for years into the future is going to be de facto the embassy, no matter what anybody in Washington says about where the embassy is technically located.
Very interesting. Thanks, Tom, for illuminating that quite complicated question. And it's fascinating what shows up in the press about this as opposed to what's actually happening in real life. Thanks so much. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
We welcome our Shin Shinim, Chen Denachi and Tamir Shakuri. Boker Tov and welcome.
Boker Tov.
So you guys have done some touring in your very few spare moments representing Israel here in America on behalf of the Weintraub Israel Center. You went to Yosemite and Lake Tahoe, saw some of the magnificent nature. You've been to the Grand Canyon. You've seen some of what we have. Just some observations as young Israelis, having seen some of the beauty of America.
So Chen and I's therapy was like to travel.
therapy after, from all the hard work you're doing because we worked too hard here.
Exactly. Every single dull moment, we just found a place to go to, like a crazy place to hike to and to drive to. We drove a lot to get to the places we wanted to, but we felt like it's our year here and we're probably not going to be here for at least 4 years. So we might as well take advantage
you
of
have-
it.
military coming up as soon as you get back, just yep. about, and then probably university after that. So it'll be a while.
Yeah, and also if, let's say, the Army gives you like 3 days, you don't fly to America and no. do a road trip.
A little too far.
Yeah, you go to Greece. Like, it's our Puerto Piñasco.
Cyprus, maybe.
Exactly.
Okay.
And we had such an amazing time. And we had some observations about how nature is here in America and like all the national parks and the national forests. And first of all, the beauty here is just incredible. And I admire how the nature here is so diverse. But also, I think I talked about this before, but the fact that you can actually drive and get to this humongous desert and then drive a little more and get to this super snowy and rainy place and then get to the biggest hole in the world and just and then see faces carved on a mountain. It's like so many different places in one state, and you can drive to all of them, like in one country.
So it is remarkable, I think, for people in many countries when they come and see the incredible natural diversity of the United States. Now, you guys had an interesting experience going to Yosemite when you realized that, unlike Israeli national parks, which have very small fees and you know, you can camp there easily, not quite like that in Yosemite in July.
Yeah, I feel like my experience with nature in America, including like, so this year, as for nature goes, we've been to the Grand Canyon, Horseshoe Bend, Antelope Canyon, Emerald Cove, which is in Lake Mead. We've been to Yosemite and Lake Tahoe. And so far, my experience was that nature is very like civilized, very like inhabited, very, like, I don't want to say commercialized because it has a negative like connotation, but kind of
it has been kind of commercialized. Even the national parks.
It's so. A little commercialized, yeah. And it's like, it's very foreign to me because in Israel, like, you go to nature and there's like barely people. Like, good luck trying to find like a store or something. And it's much cheaper and much more affordable. That's why like a lot of families choose to do that. And here, I feel like nature is much more expensive than like staying home or like, I don't know, like going to the mall. Like, nature in Israel is the cheap option, and here it's like the expensive option.
Now, that's not always true. Experience. I mean, there are state parks that are
minimal. For example, like we went to Lake Tahoe, which was like $10, or like Mount Lemmon. It's not a like national park, of course, but
it's beautiful, and you can go there easily.
It's beautiful, and you can go there easily.
But if you want to go to like the top level,
yeah,
national
but I
park
feel like
sites,
America has so
expensive.
Many beautiful things to like see and. I think it's important to try to make them as accessible and affordable as possible.
A good lesson for us from Israel, maybe, trying to allow people to get into nature without the high price tag.
But there's definitely some beautiful things that I'm very grateful I've seen. And I'm very happy that we got to see so much diversity. Like, if you go to like the Grand Canyon area into Yosemite, it's like you're in two different continents, but you're actually like only 6 hours away, maybe, from
yeah,
each other.
Yeah, kind of amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, it's crazy.
Thank you so much, guys. We will talk next week.
Thank you.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie new, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Guy goes to see his rabbi. Rabbi says, something terrible is happening. I have to talk to you about it. Rabbi asks, what's wrong? The man replies, my wife is poisoning me. The rabbi is surprised. He asks, how can that be? The man says, listen, Rabbi, I'm telling you, I'm certain she's poisoning me. What should I do? The rabbi says, look, I'll tell you what. Let me talk to your wife. I'll see what I find out. I'll let you know. A week later, the rabbi calls the guy back and says, well, I spoke to your wife. I talked to her on the phone for 3 hours. You want my advice? The guy says, yes, Rabbi, of course. And the rabbi says, take the poison. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the second portion of the book of Deuteronomy, the remarkable Sedra of Vayetchanan. Vayetchanan includes spectacular texts, the Shema, the central statement of God's oneness in the world, Shema Yisrael, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad, Hear Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one. And then it's followed immediately by the Ve'ahavta, the commandment to love God with all of our hearts, minds, and strength. And as if that were not enough for one Torah portion, Vayet Hanan also includes the recitation of the Ten Commandments, the Aseret HaDibrot, for a second time here in the Torah. If you were to rank portions, you could easily put Vayet Hanan near the very top in quality of content. It is no accident that this powerfully affirming portion is read the week after Tisha B'Av, the commemoration of the destruction of both the first and second temples on Shabbat Nachamu, the Sabbath of Consolation. For we take comfort in our knowledge that morality and holiness ultimately bring justice. The Shema itself is really just a simple sentence. Listen, Israel, God is your Lord, God is just one. A straightforward statement, one that should be easy to both understand and accept, wholeness, oneness. So simple, in fact, anybody can understand and embrace it. Although, of course, simple and true ideas can struggle for acceptance in our world. But it's the text that follows the Shema, the Ve'ahavta, that's more subtle, and in many ways an even more intriguing passage. For in that, we are commanded to love God. Ve'ahavta et Adonai Elohecha, love the Lord your God with all your mind, soul, and heart. You know, many things in life can be commanded, but love is distinctly not one of them. So what does the Torah mean when it says we are commanded to love God? Love is essentially an unconditional way of giving, of focusing attention and caring on another being. Loving God means paying attention to God, to God's existence in our world, to God's oneness, to God's moral code for us. In Judaism, we express our love of God, our ahava, by demonstrating we have learned how to listen, shma. And if we truly listen, then we will know that we must act morally. Loving God means being obligated to listen to and follow God's mitzvot, to live ethical lives, and to do so with energy and commitment. It also means that being good is a form of love, perhaps the purest form of love. This week, in a world that sometimes seems so lost in its ability to find goodness and honesty, may we all find a true way to express love through our righteous actions in mitzvot, and so affirm God in our world. When we return on to Jewish, our guest, Jonathan Ornstein, will share an incredible story about the origin of the extraordinary Jewish community center in Krakow, Poland. It involves the British royal family. Don't miss it when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
The anti-democratic Hungarian President Viktor Orban visited Israel last week. Orban presents a conundrum, at least for Jews, as he is not apparently anti-Semitic himself, although he is certainly supported in Hungary by plenty of anti-Semites. Viktor Orban has led a policy of restricting democracy in his own country. Since his re-election in 2010, after having served as a much more liberal prime minister back in 1998 to 2002, Orban has waged a legislative offensive imposing restrictions on civil society, attacking the media and the justice system. He gerrymandered voting districts in a move that helped him remain in power. And as part of his battle against human rights organizations in Hungary, Orban introduced legislation nicknamed the Stop Soros Bill, criminalizing these groups' efforts to help asylum seekers. George Soros, the prominent Jewish billionaire born in Hungary, supports many of the country's more liberal organizations. After Viktor Orban won re-election in April, Bibi Netanyahu called to congratulate him on his victory. Orban's right-wing Fidesz party won decisively, capturing two-thirds of the seat in the current parliament, notably defeating Jobbik, the extreme right-wing fascist, openly anti-Semitic party. As a result of that election, Orban now has a majority in Hungary that will enable him to amend the constitution further in his own anti-democratic favor. Under Netanyahu's leadership, Israel has now continued to draw closer to Central European countries, such as the Visegrad Group, Hungary, Poland, the Czech Republic, and Slovakia. This is an alliance that Israel partly aims to use to weaken the European Union consensus on Palestinian and Iranian issues. Perhaps. The irrepressible Jewish comedian and actor Sacha Baron Cohen has a new TV series out this week, Who is America?, a show that makes its debut on Showtime. The British Jewish comic returns with the shtick that made him famous, disguising himself in order to prank the famous and the not-so-famous. Having created Borat, the dim-witted Gazakh journalist, and Ali G, the dim-witted hip-hop journalist, Cohen now rolls out Israeli Colonel Eran Morad, a purported terrorism expert. Cohen, of course, himself speaks Hebrew. His mother is Israeli, and he has lived there at various times. Sacha Baron Cohen knows how to sound like a pseudo-Israeli. In this week's show, Cohen as Morad dupes a few current and recent politicians in America, as well as gun rights activists, into supporting a fictitious initiative to arm toddlers. The gun rights activists, Philip Van Cleve and Larry Pratt, endorse Morad's Kindergarten program. So do Trent Lott, the former top Republican senator from Mississippi, current representatives Dana Rohrabacher of California and Joe Wilson of South Carolina, both Republicans, and a former Republican rep, Joe Walsh of Illinois. In the show, all come out in favor of arming mature, trained preschoolers with guns in order to protect them from terrorists.
My name, Colonel Eran Morad. I am the terrorist terminator.
In America, there is big problem of shootings in schools. The NRA want to arm the teachers. This is crazy. They should be arming the children.
Sacha Baron Cohen's work is an obvious parody designed to show the extreme insanity of the gun advocates in America. Israel, in fact, has far stronger controls on gun ownership and use than the U.S., but by posing it as an Israeli expert on counterterrorism, he dupes, well, prominent but somewhat nuts people into playing along on putting guns into the hands of three-year-olds.
Kindergartens.
Okay.
We train them from the age 16 down to the age 3.
Yeah, well, I think it would be a good idea. We've been pushing something along this line for years, but really haven't gotten any traction with it. We were thinking 7th or 8th grade. You're talking much younger than that.
Philip Van Cleve, a prominent gun activist in Virginia, agrees to star in a video supposedly aimed at gun use for preschoolers.
Here to help teach you is Philip Van Cleve. Not every strange man you meet gonna be friendly and non-threatening like me.
Today, we're gonna teach you how you can stop these naughty men and have them take a long nap.
That's right, and that's why you're going to meet a friend of mine. His name is Papi Pistol. Now, Philip, will you show us how to feed Papi Pistol?
To feed him, take his lunchbox and push it into his tummy, like this. Just remember to point Puppy Pistol's mouth right at the middle of the bad man. If he has a big fat tummy, point at that.
Great. It's fun.
Okay.
Puppy Pistol is part of a whole group of new friends that your parents can get you, called Gunimals. Wouldn't you love to meet this little gunny rabbit?
He's ready to put the naughty man on a very long time out.
How about the magical Uzi cone?
Well, this is one for the girls. It's a lovely little unicorn that you can play with.
Dino gun can stop an entire crowd of bad men.
And Tots, you gotta learn that Dino gun eats and spits his candy really, really fast.
Rocket Ship RPG will take you to the moon.
Or rather, the bad guys are going to the moon if they attack your school with a truck full of big, scary fireworks.
And introducing BFF, a starter gun for infants 24 months and under. BFF is so easy to fire, even a baby can use it.
BFF wants to help you. Pull the string on a bad guy. Make bang bang. Aim at the head, shoulders, not the toes, not the toes.
Fire!
Head, shoulders, not the toes, not the toes.
Fire!
Eyes, ears, and belly, and nose. Head, shoulders, not the toes, not the toes.
Fire!
Trent Lott got on board, as did Congressmen Dana Rohrabacher and Joe Wilson, and former congressman-turned-lobbyist Joe Walsh.
I support the Kindergartens program. We in America would be wise to implement it, too. It's something that we should think about in America, about putting guns in the hands of law-abiding citizens, good guys, whether they be teachers or whether they actually be talented children or highly trained preschoolers.
Maybe having young people trained and understand how to defend themselves in their school might actually make us safer here.
A three-year-old cannot defend itself from an assault rifle by throwing a Hello Kitty pencil case at it. Our founding fathers did not put an age limit on the Second Amendment.
The intensive three-week kindergarten course introduces specially selected children from 12 to 4 years old to pistols, rifles, semi-automatics, and a rudimentary knowledge of mortars. In less than a month, a first grader can become a first grenader.
Wow. The problem I see with Sacha Baron Cohen's new show, Who is America, is not that it ambushes idiots into demonstrating their imbecility, but that, at least on the issue of gun violence, it's actually too frightening to be really funny. And in other news, the weird issues in Jewish life in Central and Eastern Europe do not disappear. Last week, a regional politician in Austria defended a plan to limit access to kosher meat, conditioning its sale on permits that would be individually issued to observant Jews. The draft decree was in a state of Lower Austria, one of 9 states that make up the Federal Republic of Austria. Gottfried Waldhausel, the cabinet minister in the state government of Lower Austria, who's in charge of animal welfare and some other portfolios, defended the plan as necessary from an animal welfare point of view. Waldhausel is Lower Austria's only cabinet minister from the populist Freedom Party that was created by a former Nazi SS soldier in the 1950s and opposes immigration from Muslim countries. The party has had many scandals involving anti-Semitism by its members and representatives, no great shock in Austria, though its leaders say their party is not anti-Semitic and will not tolerate expressions of such sentiments in its ranks. Oskar Deutsch, president of the Jewish community in Vienna, warned that in practice this plan would require compiling a list of Jews, which he called like a negative Aryan clause referencing racist laws passed by Nazi Germany and implemented in Austria after the Anschluss with Germany in 1938. Klaus Schneeberger, the regional leader of the ruling Austrian People's Party of Chancellor Sebastian Kurz, said this plan will not be implemented. Of course, nobody will have to register to buy kosher meat. There will be no such thing, he said. Thank goodness. And in happier news, Alex Bregman, the young Astros Jewish third baseman from Albuquerque, was the most valuable player of the Major League Baseball All-Star Game last week. Bregman was a World Series hero for the Astros last year. We offer him another Mazel Tov on his MVP award for his tie-breaking home run in the 10th inning, helping the American League to its victory. And that's the two Jewish news of Jews around the world.
We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Jonathan Orstein is the head of the Jewish Community Center of Krakow, Poland, celebrating its 10th anniversary. It's a little hard to believe. An extraordinary institution. Good morning and welcome back to Two Jewish.
Great to be here.
So I should also note that you're a previous winner of the Kohan Memorial Foundation Award and received a minor award as well this year just for the continued great work. Give us a little bit of an idea as from the perspective of the 10th anniversary of the Jewish Community Center, maybe even a little bit about its founding. But where you are right now and what you see at this moment.
Well, it's a fascinating story. You know, we in the Jewish world we associate Poland or historically have associated Poland for a while only as a place of tragedy and Jewish death because of the Holocaust. Because so much of the Holocaust happened here in Poland, and usually when
Auschwitz
is an hour's drive away from us here in Krakow at the JCC.
Right.
We have such strong associations with Poland about the Holocaust, and we generally think that the Jewish life in Poland ended with the Holocaust, and that was the end. There were survivors, they left, they went to all different communities around the world, and that's as much as we usually think about Poland in the context of Jewish life. But since 1989, something quite remarkable has been happening, which is people have started to find out they're Jewish and get involved, and the community is growing, not based on immigration, but based on Polish Jews who are the ones, survivors and their families, children and grandchildren, who after the war stayed in Poland, and then during communism, when it was difficult to be Jewish, went underground. And now, since 1989, as the country regained its freedom and there's an environment here which is a very positive environment conducive to being Jewish, young people are finding out they're Jewish and joining our community, which is why, you know, as I celebrate our 10th birthday, in the guidebooks it says there are 100 or 120 Jews in Krakow, and at this point in our little JCC we have 700 Jewish members.
Amazing. I've been stunned by the energy at this JCC, both when I was here 3 years ago, and it's not diminished. Certainly it's, I think, expanded since then. The number of young Poles, some of them of Jewish extraction, but many not, who are attracted to this community. Talk about that phenomenon, the sense that they're rediscovering something that's missing.
Yeah, so I think what's really fascinating is sort of the miracle behind the miracle. So if young people finding out they're Jewish and joining the community and the community is growing is on the top level, but behind that is this incredible amount of interest in all things Jewish among non-Jews, which helps create the environment which allows these young people, or which encourages these young people who actually have Jewish roots to get involved. So the Jewish Culture Festival, which is going on now in the end of June in Krakow, beginning of July, is the largest Jewish culture festival in the world. Yeah. It's in its 28th edition, started 30 years ago by two non-Jewish guys, one of whom is still running it.
So Genesis stories are very important. The creation of this JCC is a great story. I know you've told it many times, but it bears retelling at this 10th anniversary period.
Absolutely. It's a wonderful story. And I think that every great story needs a good creation story.
Creation myth, if
creation
you will.
Myth. Right. And I would have had to make this one up, but we have a true one.
It's a good
story. So our JCC, absolutely. Our JCC was founded by Prince Charles.
That is the Prince Charles of England, the one you've seen pictures of.
Right, absolutely. Prince Charles. The Prince of Wales, who came to Krakow on a state visit in 2002, and as part of his official visit, he came to the Jewish Quarter, to Kazimierz, which, you know, this beautiful Jewish quarter that we're in, which is the best preserved Jewish quarter anywhere in Europe. We have 7 renovated pre-war synagogues, right? The youngest is the one next to the JCC from 1862, and the oldest is from the 15th century, and you can go walking to all 7 and be back in the JCC in 10 minutes. So in a really phenomenally well-preserved Jewish quarter. So Prince Charles came for a short visit. He met with some survivors. He was very moved by their stories, first surviving the Holocaust and then outlasting communism. And he asked the question that people often ask, which is, how can I help you? And they said, we have all these beautiful synagogues. We have a place to pray. What we don't have is a place for us to be together, like a senior citizens club. And Prince Charles said, I promise I'm going to help you realize your dream. And he went back to the UK and got involved with an organization called World Jewish Relief. And they were the main organizer of the Kinder Transport. And they do a lot of work with the JDC, with the American Jewish Joint Distribution Committee,
right?
Which is a big, very large American Jewish philanthropic organization. And they took a look at Krakow, and they realized it wasn't only this older survivor community that was trailing off, that young people were starting to find out that they were Jewish. Two people would meet in a pub, and they'd say, oh, we're the only Jews. And say, oh, my friend has a Jewish father, and oh, this one I work with has a Jewish mother. All right, bring them next week. And 2 became 4, became 6, and World Jewish Relief tapped into that, and they saw that there was, you know, the potential for something more, and they went back to the prince and they said, instead of doing something only to serve this survivor community that we know about, we think that there's more potential here. What if we do something like a JCC to serve as a hub for these young people finding out they're Jewish? Prince Charles, in his infinite wisdom, said okay and got involved, gave some financial support, and then with the prince's involvement, the project became a lot more viable. And in 2008, Prince Charles and Camilla, the Duchess of Cornwall, came, spent the day with us, opened the JCC, and for a nice Jewish boy from Queens, I was Prince Charles's host. It was a pretty cool way to spend the day.
Let's see, what china did you use?
Yeah, we brought in the best china you can imagine.
It's 10th anniversary, 10th celebration, also, is it the 20th, 30th, really, of the Jewish festival? So a couple of really nice connections. Tell us a little bit about the Ride for the Living. I get to talk about it myself because I have the privilege of going on it, but tell us how it evolved.
We're very excited to have you and your son here. Ride for the Living is a phenomenal, really, I think, one of the coolest events that we do. So the Ride for the Living is a bicycle ride. It's a one-day, 55-mile bicycle ride from Auschwitz to the JCC to celebrate Jewish life. And the story is that in 2014, a Jewish guy from London named Robert met a Polish woman, and he decided to move to Poland to be with her. And instead of doing what sane people do, which is get on a plane. He is a young, sporty guy, and he decided to ride his bike from London to Poland.
Oh, yeah.
So he rode his bike 3 weeks, 1,350 miles. He was a bit of a history buff, and he stopped at sites related to the Holocaust and to World War II, and he blogged about it, and he made a film about it, and he did a lot to raise awareness about the Holocaust, and he finished in Auschwitz. And he came to the JCC, we became friends, and he found something he wasn't expecting to find in Krakow, which is living Jews.
And what everyone finds, right, when they come here.
Exactly, a growing, thriving Jewish community. So we're sitting around one day, a few of us, and we said, Robert, this is wonderful what you've done. You rode your bike all the way, you schlepped all the way over, you reduced the carbon footprint for all the rest of us that are flying. Thank you for that. But you finished in Auschwitz. And if you think about it, Auschwitz is not a place that you finish if you have a choice not to finish there. So let's finish the ride in a better place. Let's finish the ride that you didn't complete. Let's go from Auschwitz, a place of darkness, to the JCC, a place of light. From Auschwitz, a place of tragedy, to JCC, a place of hope. We'll finish your ride together. We'll do it. We'll call it Ride for the Living, because we'll do it to support the local Jewish community. And let's see. So we had 15 riders that first year, 5 years ago. We raised money to bring a group of hidden children, of child Holocaust survivors, to Israel. We went on a mission with them to Israel for a week. Many of them had never been to Israel, went all over the country, all paid for from the bicycle ride. We went to Yad Vashem. They all paid tribute to the non-Jewish Poles who had saved them. It was very emotional. We said, this is great. We're onto something. We got to do the ride again. So we do it again the next year. We have 85 participants. And about a month before the ride, we get a call. And the guy says, hello, my name is Marcel from Canada. We go, oh, great. Somebody from Canada called. You know, the ride is, we're picking up traction, right? We're going worldwide. And he goes, oh, and I was born in Krakow. And we go, okay, really? He goes, and I'm 80 years old. And I'm an Auschwitz survivor. And he tells us his story that as a 10-year-old boy, he was liberated from the camp January 27th, and he was in terrible shape, as you would imagine. And he walked with a few of the other children from Auschwitz to Krakow. He was looking for his family. His whole family had been murdered, except for his mother. His mother then found him a few months later. They stayed in Poland for a while, where he became a cyclist. Then they moved to Israel, and from Israel he moved to Montreal. And now, as all the good Jewish cyclists in Montreal does, he spends his winters cycling in Boca. And can he come on the ride? We're like, Marcel, you had us at Canada. Can you come on the ride? So Marcel Zielinski comes on the ride. He brings his son and his two granddaughters who live in Israel. And instead of looking for the murdered family that he lost, he is riding with his family, his own family, with the reborn Jewish community of Krakow, with 85 participants from all around the world. And we ride along the same path that he walked when he was liberated as a 10-year-old. And since then, Marcel has been back all 3 years. He's back on this, our fifth anniversary ride. We have another Holocaust survivor who's 89. Marcel is now 83. I have an 89-year-old cyclist coming. We have people from 10 different countries.
You know, when these guys go faster than I do, there's going to be a certain shame.
I hear you. I'm with you on that one, Rabbi. And we have over 220 participants this year, including, we just found out, which is an incredible coup for us.
Greg LeMond.
That three-time Tour de France winner, the only American to win the Tour de France, Greg LeMond, is coming on 2018 Ride for the Living.
Amazing. I have to meet him. This is amazing. Fantastic.
So now we have to be worried about trying to keep up with two Holocaust survivors who are 80.
And a three-time Tour de France winner. And his wife, who's probably as good as he is.
Absolutely.
I want to thank Jonathan Arcee for a great visit. I feel like we could keep going forever. Mazel tov on the 10th anniversary of the JCC Krakow on this incredible Ride for the Living, and just continued success.
Always great to talk to you, Rabbi. Thank you for being with us.
When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball. Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning here on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday on Too Jewish. Our guest will be David Krakauer, the spectacular klezmer clarinetist. And of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or at our TooJewishRadio.com website. Our playout this morning comes from David Krakauer, next week's guest, playing with Frank London's Klezmer All-Star Orchestra at the Krakow Jewish Festival. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.